Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey y'all, I'm your host Alex, and this is Mountain State Mysteries. Mark and Courtney took this week off, so they passed the mic to me to talk about a case. If you don't know me, my name is Alex. I'm from St. Paul Unsolved in West Virginia. You can usually find me on YouTube or Facebook, Instagram. So if you want to look me up, you can do that. Like my channel, subscribe, follow me on Facebook, all that fun jazz that, you know, influencers, I guess, are supposed to say. The case I have for you today is one of West Virginia's most troubling unsolved disappearances. On December 10th, 1986, a woman vanished after leaving her son's home in St. Albans. 2 days later, her shoes and eyeglasses were found outside her apartment, but she was nowhere to be found. As investigators searched for answers, suspicion fell on her estranged husband, a former West Virginia state trooper, just days before their divorce hearing. Nearly 40 years later, Darlita's fate remains unknown. This is the case of Darlita K. Hurt. This case touches my heart because she actually lived in the same town as I do. So, when she was married, she lived in the same town I do. So it's very near and dear to my heart. It's why I wanted to cover it. And so let's just get right in. Darlita was born Darlita K. Wilson. She was born on July 18th, 1938. She was a white female, 48 years old at the time. She was between 5'5 and 5'7 and around 125 to 130 pounds. She had black or dark brown curly hair and hazel eyes. She did have a scar on her nose. Her ears are pierced. And I don't usually mention this, but I do want to mention she did have breast implants, just in case anyone were to find a body, that would be something that you would notice if, not to be gruesome, she wasn't completely decomposed, right? She was very easy to talk to, and she was a listener. She was not judgmental at all. And even her kids talk about it was so easy to tell her pretty much anything. She worked at Union Carbide Technical Center in South Charleston, and she did work with her son, Craig, and her son-in-law, Gary. But they were more at the main plant at Institute, but being Union Carbide workers, sometimes there was a little overlap.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
Now let's talk a little bit about her husband, Robert Lee Hurt. He was born on August 30th, 1937. He was a horse lover and a lieutenant for the West Virginia State Police. They got married in 1980 and they bought a horse farm in Scott Depot in 1981 on 164 Burns Road. Now, like I said, this is close to me, so this case, again, it's kind of near and dear to my heart. Robert was able to get several horses in the barn on the property. So being a horse lover, this is probably one of the big reasons they chose this property. They ended up having three children together. One that I've already named, Randall Craig. He went by Craig though. Tara, who Gary was married to, and Kimberly. In April 1986, they did decide to separate. Robert moved out of the home and stayed with a coworker for several months. They did try to work things out though. In July, Robert then retired from the state police. He did accept the job as an investigator for the legislative commission. And by September, things were getting exceptionally worse between them. Darlita did end up moving out of the house for a little bit. She was worried about his mental and physical health, and he had made a suicide attempt at this point. Now, in the fall, they did try to go to marriage counseling. It really seemed like Darlita, and I guess in ways Robert too, were really trying pretty much anything to save this marriage, but by November, Darlita did catch Robert cheating. This caused her to move out again and for the final time before her disappearance, and she ended up signing a one-year lease at an apartment on Kanaw Terrace in St. Albans. Two of her kids lived around this area and she really liked it, so she thought it would be a good area so she could be closer to them. Darlita filed for divorce due to irreconcilable differences, and the divorce was definitely difficult. Robert was not taking it well at all, and they agreed that their home and 5 acres around it of the 24-acre property on Poplar Fork Road, which is, you know, where Burns Road is, would be sold and they would split the profit. And after that property sold, Robert would have to buy Darlita out of the rest of the acreage. On December 6th, Darlita's Subaru that she was borrowing from Craig's wife, was what she was using at this time, started acting up. So when she got it towed to get it looked at, they ended up finding at least 3 cups of sugar in her gas tank. So she clearly went to the police and filed a formal complaint for vehicular tampering. And of course, we all believe at this point, allegedly, I guess, that Robert did this. She said things were just getting a lot worse with Robert, so that's why she believed it was him. On December 9th, Darlita reported that she had also gotten a call from Robert while she was at work, and Robert was threatening her, saying, quote, she had better protect her eyes because he was going to get them. And her coworkers said she was just really shook up after this. Now, on December 10th, 1986, I want to point out that she was wearing a dark blue wool dress or skirt. It was maroon with blue stripes, a wide blue belt, suntan hose, a black 3/4 length tweed coat, black high heels, silver earrings, and a gray pocketbook. She had called her work early saying that she was going to be late. And she then went to Century 21 in Taze Valley to sign papers to let the farm be put up for sale. Around 9:30 a.m., she got to Carbide and she asked to have all her calls screened and to only put females through to her. Now, I want to point out that Robert did try to call, and she probably didn't want to talk to him because of all the paperwork with the farm. He was not handling that well, right? But based on how upset she had been because of Robert and, you know, We know that he was calling and threatening her at work. No coworkers actually told her he called this day. Now, Tara did call to discuss when Darlito wanted her and her daughter to come visit later that evening, but all other calls were business related. And again, she only had females put through to her. Now, the coworkers did say that she was visibly not good this day. She said that she hadn't slept the whole night before, and she had even said, quote, "Fear is a terrible thing to live with." Around 4:45 p.m., Darlena left work and drove down Route 60 and turned towards St. Albans. She went to a place called Western World. It was a Western type shop on McCorkle Avenue, and she ended up buying a pair of bootcut jeans and a gray men's shirt with four buttons. Around 5:15 to 5:30 p.m., she then went to her son's house on Valley Park Drive and had dinner with her family and his brand new baby, her new grandchild. And around 6:30, she did tell her son she needed to leave and get home and told him that she was waiting for a call from Tara to see when she was coming over this evening. So she ended up leaving around 6:40, 6:50 p.m., and it really should have only taken her about 5 minutes to get home, unless she stopped and did an errand, but she really didn't mention that because she said she wanted to get home so she didn't miss Tara's call. Around 7, Craig realized that she had forgotten her jar of chili, so he tried to call her around 7:05 at her apartment, but no one answered. He then tried to call Tara to see if she had seen or talked to Darlita, and Tara just said she wasn't there either. So her husband, Gary, said he would drive by Darlita's on the way to Craig's and check on her. So around 7:35, Gary headed to her apartment and rang the doorbell. No one answered, but he did notice that her mail was still in her mailbox. He didn't really check the back parking lot, so he wasn't sure if her car was there at this time. So he just headed to Craig's to let him know that she wasn't there, and it didn't really look like to him she had been there because the mailbox still had mail in it. So around 8:45, Gary was leaving Craig's and said he would stop by again. At this point, he did notice that her car was for sure there. He rang the doorbell again and there was still no answer. Gary then drove back to Craig's and told him what he saw. Around 9:10 p.m., Craig and Gary both drove to the apartment again. They parked in the back parking lot and Craig had a key, so they went into her apartment and they checked each and every room thoroughly. And again, it just did not look like she made it back inside her apartment, even though her car now was for sure there. Craig and Gary started tracing Darlita's path. She would be walking from her car to her apartment, but to them, nothing really seemed weird about it. Craig and Gary then looked at Darlita's car. The car did have dew on it, so the car had been sitting there for a while by this point, and her car was locked, so they couldn't get in because neither of them had a key, but they could look inside the windows. And they did notice that she had a tote bag and a legal pad of paper in the passenger front seat. So I'm assuming this was her work stuff. So again, it didn't look like she made it in her house because she probably would have brought this bag inside with her. So they ended up getting home around 10 p.m. and Craig tries to call Robert, but he answered and hung up immediately. So then Tara tries to call Robert around 10:10 p.m. and the call just went straight to the answering machine.
Hey y'all, I'm Dan. And I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcast.
The next morning, Craig started calling Darlita at her apartment before 5:30 a.m. and she still wasn't answering. He waited until he knew she would be at work and started calling Darlita at Carbide around 8:30 a.m., but her coworkers told him that she was not there and hadn't called in, and this was just not like her. So it even kind of freaked coworkers out. Gary then drove to her apartment and her car was still there, but she seemed to still not be there. So then Craig goes to Carbide, and around 10 a.m., Craig, you know, lets Gary know what's going on, and Craig and Gary let their work know, hey, this is what's happening with Darlita, and they were able to leave. So they went to the horse farm. Now, Robert wasn't home, and they searched the house while they were there, but nothing was found. They then drove back to Darlita's and searched everything again and still found nothing. And this is when Craig just decided he had to call the St. Albans Police Department to report Darlita missing. There was no bank activity since December 10th. They did label her as an endangered missing. They expected foul play and classified it as a suspected homicide pretty much right away. That evening, Craig, Gary, and Sergeant Bobby Sparks went to Darlita's apartment and they searched everything again with an officer this time. That night, Lieutenant Homer Clark from St. Albans Police Department and Robert Harrison from Putnam County Sheriff's Department drove to the horse farm and told Robert Darlita was missing. He said that he had no idea where Darlita could be. He also told them that they could search his house, and they also found nothing. Lieutenant Clark then brought a canine German Shepherd to the property that was trained on human location and walked him around the property, but he never detected anything. Now, me and especially Mark, we've worked with a canine service before, and I've never been able to remember to ask Nathan this question, but I'm not sure if human location also means just alive people, maybe corpses too. I'm not really sure. But I feel like that's a question me and Mark should ask Nathan, because if it was just trained on humans that are alive, like, you know, just on Darlita's scent, I don't know if it would have detected if Darlita was there and had already passed away, or if that doesn't even matter with canines, like Darlita's scent is Darlita's scent. On December 12th, members of the St. Albans Police Department started searching also. They even started talking to houses in the area to see if they saw or heard something. So on the morning of December 13th, Lieutenant Clark and Officer Dryden went back to the apartment to search again. Around 9 a.m., Officer Dryden spotted Darlita's shoes in the grass around 30 feet away from her car. They called Craig over immediately, and Craig was able to positively say that these were Darlita's shoes that she was wearing that night. They then had stepped off the sidewalk and went like on different sides of this light pole, and Craig said he found his mother's apartment key right there. So they took this stuff to the police department. They were also able to find her glasses off the side of the sidewalk, and they were bent and scratched and also had tobacco around them. So this was also taken to the police department. St. Albans Police Department talked to multiple coworkers and people that lived close to the horse farm, but there was no way to really collect fingerprints, dentals, or DNA on Darlita, and nobody seemed to have seen anything. But I think that it's more than apparent to mention, she disappeared 5 days before her divorce hearing. So police really found this sketchy, right? This was really sketchy, which caused Robert to end up being the main suspect. They asked Robert what he was up to the day Darlita went missing. There is no audio, but there are handwritten notes that people have went off of for this. And he said that he was working on his tractor. There were two women that came by his place twice. One around 8 p.m. and said that they didn't actually see Robert, but his truck was there, so they had just assumed he was too. And Robert said that he was cleaning and working on his tractor at this time and just, you know, supposedly had came out just as they were leaving. Around 9:40 p.m. though, he was there, so they asked him to trim the bottom of their Christmas tree. And they said that he seemed to act perfectly normal during this. So, you know, they had never suspected anything weird that day. He said that the last time he saw Darlita was Monday night on the 8th, and that they talked about the sale of the farm. He said he never threatened her about her eyes, and that was a total lie, and he didn't even know where she got it from. He did say that he told her there would be a day of reckoning, though, which, in my opinion, is still a threat, but whatever. He did say he didn't think he left the farm the day that Darlita went missing, but he actually spent most of his day in Milton. He stopped by Craig's around noon in St. Albans to drop off Christmas presents. And then he drove to South Charleston Detachment of the West Virginia State Police, so there were even officers there that saw them. And each place, like I said, had several people there that said he was at these places. So we know for sure he was in Milton, he was in St. Albans, and he was in South Charleston this day. Law enforcement to this day still believes that she's buried somewhere on that 24-acre horse farm, but Robert was uncooperative with law enforcement. He said that she just simply ran off, claimed that she had done this before, and Robert claimed that he was cooperative at first, but it got really hard mentally and emotionally to continue to be, so he stopped. Darlita's dad formally requested Darlita's case to be taken by the West Virginia State Police on January 3rd, 1987. He said that the family was just worried St. Albans Police Department didn't have enough resources for this case, and it was granted on January 7th to be taken over by the state police. Sergeant R.J. Blair was assigned to her case, and by March 1987, Sergeant Blair was getting visibly frustrated at Robert because he would not cooperate. Media had also figured out that there was tension, so the media started pressuring Robert to speak to them also. Robert just said that he could not handle it anymore, physically or mentally, like we've already heard, and it was clear that he was getting very close to a mental breakdown. And people started requesting Robert to be dismissed from his job completely.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
And I said this in my video, I understand where her family was coming from with requesting Darlita's case to be taken over by the state police. But I also think a lot of police forces deal with the good old boy system. And it's kind of shocking to me that they would want the police, like law enforcement entity that Robert used to work for, to take this over. Now, I also want to preface, it seems that actually every police department that had their hands in this case did absolutely everything they could to find Darlita, and we just don't hear that very often, right? But I do think it's very interesting that her family would have the West Virginia State Police take over, since these people actually knew and used to work and were probably friends with Robert. But like I said, they did a great job, so I'm trying not to be too critical about that point. Now, on June 23rd, 1987, around 10:15 p.m. at the West Virginia Turnpike Commission headquarters, Robert became the main suspect of a shooting of Trooper Charles Bowles. Charles was sitting at his desk filling out paperwork, and he was alone in the facility due to how late it was. Someone had walked up to the window and shot their gun, like, through the window at him. It first shot Trooper Bowles in the upper shoulder, which caused his body to fall forward to the desk, which caused his chair to also lean forward and angle itself down. This caused the second bullet to actually hit the chair and completely rip it wide open and hit him in the back. Now, they do think that actually saved him, having that barrier between the chair and his back. I'll talk about that a little bit later, but thank God that the second bullet hit the chair like that. Trooper Bowles was taken to CAMC, and the police guarded his room, and he did seem to be in good condition based on, you know, the circumstances. Trooper Bowles did end up surviving, thankfully, and like I said, that chair saved his life. Captain Fred Dickinson did say that, quote, in all probability, Trooper Charles Bowles was most likely shot by Robert Hurt based on circumstantial evidence. He was listed as the prime suspect because he had ties at that detachment, and he did seem to be jealous of Trooper Bowles because a girl that Robert was seeing had said that Bowles' body was attractive. I'm not even kidding. This man shot him twice because a girl thought Trooper Bowles was hot. That's it. He owned the same type of shotgun that shot Bowles, a 16-gauge double-barrel shotgun, so that also made him the prime suspect. There was no motive other than Trooper Bowles, I guess, being hot that was ever really pinpointed, but they did state that he was going through a lot emotionally and had a lot going on, like personal problems, clearly with the Darlita thing, and they think that probably sent him over the edge and really clouded his judgment. And this led to Robert being suspended finally from his job at the West Virginia legislature. On July 1st, 1987, around 7 p.m., Robert was found slumped over his steering wheel of his tractor by a family friend that came to check on him, and he had been shot in the chest. He was taken to CAMC Memorial by an ambulance. He tried to say he had no idea who would have done this to him, and the investigators were already questioning things, which, when they went to his house and looked around, it was proven that Robert, I'm not kidding you, had tied a handgun to a tree branch in a field on his farm. And he had it rigged on the tractor when they released the clutch that it would release the branch and cause the gun to go off as the tractor started moving. So they were able to prove that this gunshot was clearly self-inflicted and that he probably did it to make it look like someone else did it, even though it was a clear, I don't know, suicide attempt, I guess, but you know, it looked like he was trying to frame someone for his suicide attempt. Now, Robert did survive these injuries, and this is when they decided he would stay suspended, but now it would be without pay. On July 10th, though, 9 days later, around 10:30 p.m., Robert was found inside his 1977 Dodge pickup truck inside of the garage at his horse farm with the engine running. And it was clear that Robert committed suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning. He had locked himself in the garage with his car running. I mean, that's unfortunately how people do it. So we might never see justice. Well, we won't probably see justice for Darlita if we were to ever find her, because Robert is no longer alive, and really, he's the only suspect we have in Darlita's disappearance. After his funeral, six troopers began searching for the body of Darlita on the horse farm. Their son Craig had given them permission to search, but I'm pretty sure he really just wanted to get through the funeral first. They did find a pair of bootcut jeans in the ground near the driveway, and it is thought to be the jeans she had bought at Western World, but they could never like distinctly prove this, but it was a hell of a coincidence, right? But that's really all they ever found. A German Shepherd from Virginia was brought in to help search, but they found nothing of importance. Sergeant Angus said that it was unlikely that she was buried somewhere else, and said it was highly unlikely that they will ever find out what happened to Darlita. You got to think that horse farm is 24 acres. That is a massive amount of land to search, even with dogs. And I mean, honestly, she could be anywhere out there. Now, I want to go over who to contact in case you do have any type of information on Darlita by chance. She is in the DOE network. Her identification number is 4921DFWV, and her NamUs number is MP33127. And you can contact the St. Albans Police Department, Major Mike Ferry, at 304-727-2251. And her agency case number is 860-7629. Now, a year after Darlita's disappearance, the family planned a memorial service for her at River Lawn Presbyterian Church in St. Albans. Her NamUs page was made on March 29th, 2016. So like I said, you can look her up on there. And her children wanted to be able to declare their mom dead around 1989. The family argued that they were still having to pay her bills because, I mean, even though she was missing, it's not like these bills just didn't exist. They were still making payments on her life insurance policy, and they were making around $890 monthly payments on her parents' home. If she was declared dead, these expenses would be stopped, and the kids argued it was draining their bank accounts, paying their own set of bills, and also trying to keep up with their mothers. Her children said they would just like to close this chapter and move on with the rest of their lives. And Craig had stated, "We could tell her the kind of things any normal kid would have been beaten to death for. She'd say, 'I'll tell you what I think is right.' She didn't pass judgment. That's the way she was with her family. Myself and both of my sisters both thought of her as much as our best friend as our mother." So it was just so clear the love that these kids had for their mom, right? And I know I keep calling them children and kids. Obviously, they were grown adults. But it was a big deal to have their mother in their life. And I can't imagine not having my mom. So I can't imagine it was easy for them. But that is the case of Darlita Hurt. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find good West Virginia true crime podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries. Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com. For our show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com. And again, my name is Alex. I'm APOL Unsolved in West Virginia. You can find me on YouTube. You can find me on Facebook. Those are my main platforms. I'm also on Instagram. And thank you guys for letting me come on. And Mark and Courtney will be back next week.